From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Greedy and needy. That's the image of older people that our culture often presents in media, entertainment, advertising. But our guest today says this picture is way off base. We're talking this hour with Joseph Coughlin. He's founder and director of the MIT Age Lab and author of the new book, The Longevity Economy: Unlocking the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. In it, Coughlin says businesses, nonprofits, and governments that cling to the standard, mostly negative stereotypes of the elderly do so at their peril. Today in The Exchange, we explore these themes with Joseph Coughlin, and let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Joseph Coughlin joins us from MIT. And Joe, it's really nice to have you. Thank you very much.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about that misrepresentation that you talk about of older people in our society. Greedy and needy, you write. Yikes. How so? In what ways are older people portrayed as greedy and needy?
You know, for decades, we've kind of fostered this image of older folks being greedy and needy. And I want you to just think of three images that, whether it's fair or not, we somehow equate with older adults. The blue plate special, which is somewhere between punchline and making a point, if you will. We often look at entitlements as the fastest growing part of the budget in states and federal government, thinking, well, that's only for those older people, which, of course, it's not. And then, of course, the discounts, whether it's the matinee discount or something at the store discount. So we have defined this population as being needy and being greedy about the things that they want. And in fairness, many of these so-called discounts and entitlements, and indeed the blue plate specials, were created at a time when the older adult was the poorest and the most alone and indeed the most needy. But of course, that was before 1964, and things have changed quite a bit.
So older people are not as needy as they used to be economically. And what about health-wise, you know, sort of needing assistance? There's that stereotype, too, there, that if you're older, you know, the stereotype of helping the little old lady across the street.
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, there's a fine line between just showing plain respect and courtesy, as well as the notion that one is always needy. Now, certainly there are those who are economically not well off, particularly in certain areas of the city and in rural areas. But also when you speak about health, you know, I want you to think about the following. There's a difference between ill and sick. Most of us, believe it or not, are ill. We have a chronic condition, asthma, allergy, high blood pressure, diabetes. But that doesn't mean it's not managed well enough so that you're not sick, but you're typically ill, which means you can, you know, walk the dog, do your garden, work part-time, volunteer with Verve. And so, yeah, illness is certainly something that correlates with old age, but old age does not necessarily mean you're sick.
You say, Joe, that this false depiction, this needy, greedy picture of senior citizens is not only wrong, it's dangerous, you say. And when I read that, I thought, okay, hurtful maybe, off base maybe, but dangerous. In what way?
Well, let's take it from a societal level first. The first danger is, imagine this, the fastest growing part of not just the United States population, but around the world, are people over age 50. By 2047, there will be more people over the age of 60 worldwide than kids under 15. And we're already seeing that here in the United States and Canada. And as you know, New Hampshire being the second highest concentration of older adults to this part of its population. So here's the thing. The danger part is if we take this fastest growing, amazing part of the population, 1 in 5 adults in the next couple years, and we say that they are going to be cordoned off as this needy, greedy, not productive part of society. Well, let's put it this way. If you do that with 20% of the older population, and we basically argue the same for kids from 0 to 18, 0 to 20, essentially, as a society, we've basically put 40% of the folks off the grid. That's just on a societal level. But on an individual level, You know, people have to have a reason to get up in the morning. They have to have a sense of purpose and engagement. And we must engage these folks not just for societal good, but to keep them engaged in society so that they're healthy, they're well, and certainly not a cost. And frankly, their part is for individuals. Geez, if we define people as only being needy, greedy, and sick, what kind of things are we going to develop for them that are going to excite and delight them across the lifespan?
Well, and that gets to the product development and some of the cringeworthy products that businesses have created because they have this impression. But I'm really interested in what you just said, Joe. You know, we've got this large and growing group of older folks. You know, what does that mean for our future if we put them off the grid? What does that mean exactly, putting them off the grid? How do we do that now?
Well, as I like to say in my book, The Longevity Economy, old age is made up. And many people are going to say, you think so, guy? My arthritis or whatever is
yeah,
not made up.
Exactly.
Well, and we should not equate stiffness and aches and pains and needing our shots and whatever with old age. The old age that we have made up in society is basically something that's only 100, 150 years old in terms of what we mean by a retirement. We had this idea, as I write about it, called vital energy. And the idea was that you were given from providence, divine providence, just a certain amount of energy in life. And depending on how well you used it, or if you used it badly, and you can use your imagination what that means, you were going to age quickly and, frankly, you'd be kaput. That's it. And so as a result, we invented things like rest homes, and then we know nursing homes, and most of us in all of mine also know of a certain age, the next home that comes after that is the funeral home. And so we made old age into always being a negative, if you will. And as a result, we now look at it as not as an opportunity, which longevity is, but we look at it as a cost.
Well, black balloons for certain birthdays and cards that say you're over the hill. In other words, it's all downhill from here. But where does this come from, Joe?
You know, it's interesting is that we've greatly underestimate the power of story, the power of the narrative that guides our lives. And the narrative of old age in many ways was written so that in a time when we were doing factories where we changed people out the way we changed equipment, or we needed lots of young people to provide the labor for a farm, the idea was to create this narrative where there was a natural time for you to essentially get off the grid, to get out of the way for those younger people that were auguring for your job, or we needed young, able bodies to have a productive factory. Essentially, we were running society the way we would run a mill. Well, the problem is that, A, we have a lot more older people, but secondly, work isn't that way anymore. And society has changed dramatically, where quite often what you do with your hands is done by machine, or what you do and know in your mind is of greater value than how much weight you can lift. And the narrative was created so that we could keep young, able people employed and factories productive, and frankly, just keeping people moving along the life course.
So the farm factory model, yeah. So keep it moving. Now, today we hear in New Hampshire, I mean, every week somebody comes into my studio and says, workforce, workforce, workforce. We need people. And maybe we'll talk a little bit later, Joe, about keeping older workers on the job to satisfy some of those workforce demands.
Absolutely.
But who perpetuates this story today? I mean, you're describing an economy of, 50, 60, 70 years ago, but the mythology is still with us. So who is keeping that mythology alive?
Well, if you think about it, it's all baked in. So I'll give you a couple points. The first thing is that our public policies have baked it in as well in terms of looking at pensions and the narrative of retirement. So when I say baked in, people naturally look at 65 as that's the retirement age. Now, some of us at 67, some of us 62, but 65 seems to be, shall we say, the golden year for retirement. And why? You know, life expectancy now has the fastest growing part of the population, not just being 50 plus, but 85 plus. So why 65? Why not 60? Why not 75? The fact is, it was made up. So our pensions, our retirements, our companies have made that somehow to be old age. When, by the way, most people define old age as 20 years older than whoever's answering the question, just as a side point. but also companies that have really done everything they could for the baby boom generation, those folks born between 1946 and 64, have gotten so focused and so successful and indeed so profitable focusing in on the youth. Well, now the baby boomers are, shall we say, reaping what they have sown, which is that we taught business so well to focus on the 18 to 30, 18 to 35. Now that most of the baby boomers are well twice that age, they are finding themselves, shall we say, being ignored. So it's baked in by business. And then finally, those of us as individuals. These narratives guide our life stage. We have a natural sense as to what we should be doing at some certain age. You know, the what do you want to be when you grow up, or act your age. Well, we actually step up to the narrative that's around us. And unfortunately, many of us believe that 65 is the time to take a sidestep or to walk a beach. What we forget is that we've got about 20 plus years for most of us over 65 of walking the beach. That's a lot of walking.
Well, and in the book, you talk about a group of healthy, older, successful, wealthy, retired CEOs who are just basically hitting golf balls all day long, and their wives are, you know, kind of tearing their hair out saying, isn't there more than this?
I have to say, it was somewhat surreal. I mean, for those, and I may not ever be allowed into Naples again. Naples, Florida, is known to have the highest concentration of retired CEOs in the country. And I went there with a full expectation that, look, these guys have health, they have wealth, they have wives, typically, if you will, 15, 20 years younger than they are. And when you went to go see these folks, it looked like you were going to a used Maserati car lot. So they, shall we say, by many popular definitions, had it all. And as you point out, as I write in the book, they had nothing. They showed up every day at the driving range, which might be fun for a while. And then they would go from there to the club and beat the ball for 18 holes and then have a liquid lunch or darn close to it. And then quite often when you ask their wives, and so you do this maybe once or twice a week, oh, no, the boys are here every day. And so just for fun, I did the calculations that if you golf between 65 and, say, about 82, and you take about a month off and you give about 2 weeks for being sick and you take all the federal holidays off, do you know that's 3,000 rounds of golf? So if they don't have a narrative, if they don't have a dream of what to do with 20% or, frankly, one-third of your adult life, how about the rest of us?
Well, so they're off the grid. Those
yes,
guys are off the grid. And you're suggesting that they could be doing more. Is it clear that they want to be doing more, Joe? Maybe they want to play golf.
You know, exactly. And maybe I'm just a little jealous because the way I play golf is more like a sentence than it is a reward. But there's a couple little anecdotes. One of them, of course, yeah, they want to play golf. But largely, a lot of us do, and I know a lot of people are going to push back on this, do what we were told by common narrative, movies, magazines, retailers, and what to wear, what to do. But one of the things that was really telling is that these folks were complaining about the fact that they had retired from a world where the world came to them. People wanted their opinion. They wanted their input. People briefed them on what was hot and what was not. And now, as I said, the best they could get was to get the local newspaper or to go online for what was hot in the media. That they were now not just off the grid in terms of their own engagement and productivity, but the world sequestered them off. And if you think about some of the most prestigious, high-end 50-plus communities, they're gated. They're not just keeping things out. They're also keeping people in. So I'm not suggesting that after a certain age, you must continue work. But I am suggesting that in the new longevity economy, we must now create new narrative where we must be doing something.
And pull people back onto the grid in ways that they choose, but that makes them happy, productive, healthier, really.
Healthier, absolutely. Not just having a reason to get up in the morning, but one of and I guess this is an old phrase that's been around, but it was new to me a couple years ago, which is particularly the highest divorce rate in the country is amongst the 50 plus. And women would repeatedly tell me that the reason why they were asking for the divorce, majority of them were women asking for the divorce, was, I don't know who this man is that is now sitting on my couch. I married him for life, not for lunch. And the idea is, and so a lot of men in other interviews I was doing actually went back to work, not for the money, but simply to get out of the house, as one guy said to me, otherwise she was going to kill me.
Well, let's invite our listeners to join us, and then we have so much to talk about, Joe. The number for you to be with us this morning is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guest today is Joseph Coughlin, founder and director of the MIT Age Lab and author of the brand new book, The Longevity Economy, Inside the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. What do you think is misunderstood about older people in our society? Do you agree with Joe or not that older people are put off the grid, not allowed to participate as fully as they might like? We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. And Joe, let's go to our listeners. And joining us from Manchester is Dave. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Morning. Go ahead.
I find it fascinating that, the most selfish generation that ever was, the baby boomers, is here complaining about their being treated in their older years the same way they treated their parents. At the same time, as you're worried about jobs, economic security, a vital lifestyle, you're complaining about golfing instead of working, when you've left behind an economy that no young people are ever going to have the economic opportunities that that generation did. There's no retirement for that. These generations, I'm 50 years old too, so I'm not a millennial kid whining, but I think it's really ironic that you want to shift the conversation when you've left nothing behind for future generations. They're never going to be able to retire at 65. It's really interesting that these are the complaints coming. Thank you.
Well, Dave, I'm glad you called. And, you know, let's cover that that issue, Joe. You know, baby boomers known as being selfish, and maybe you shouldn't be complaining now. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, and thank you, Dave, for the comments, because those are good takeoff points. Look, I'm at the tail end of the baby boomer, so I am part of the one-time largest, but certainly indeed the loudest, if not most obnoxious generation in history. So I will take credit for that. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that, as the great prophet Jimmy Buffett once said, we are the people your parents warned you about. And so when I was talking to the folks down there in Naples that were golfing and the like, I looked to them, shall we say, as these are the folks who had it all. And if they can't figure it out, then what is for the rest of us? And I guess I want to take you up on the point about sustaining, you know, what we're going to leave behind, and no other generation is going to be able to retire at 65. Is it possible that as much as the baby boomers have got, shall we say, Macbeth bloodstains on their hands, is it possible that the economy and society has structurally changed based upon how long we're living, how new technology is happening, how jobs that never existed only 5 years ago now are the fastest growing jobs, are not just about the baby boomers, but have structurally started to leave others behind, the millennials, Gen X, and the like? And by the way, being able to retire at 65, again, that is made up. There's no reason that any, whether it's the baby boomers, the millennials, or Generation Z, who's already coming online, should anticipate 65 as some sort of preordained right, nor necessarily reality.
Well, Dave, thank you for the call. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. You know, Joe, you write that it's been clear for a long time, that we were going to have this aging baby boom generation. So I'm glad Dave brought up that point. We all knew it was coming, and yet you write, companies, nonprofits, governments are not getting ready. Pretty stunning. Why aren't they getting ready?
You know, all organizations and frankly, individuals, if you just look at the way we plan for retirement, we know that eventually, with any luck, we're going to get older because, shall we say, the alternative is not nearly as pretty. So whether it's individuals or institutions, we don't look decades ahead. And unlike economics, where we spend a lot of money forecasting what the future is going to be, which is somewhere between witchcraft and mathematics, or technology forecasting, which is one part hope, one part engineering, demography is destiny. And the trouble is institutions and individuals don't like to look decades ahead. They look at, you know, the next quarterly report or the next election. So our vision tends to be in 2-4 year increments if it's government, unfortunately. And for businesses, it's the next quarterly report or annual report. So, yeah, the boomers have been coming and coming and coming. Well, my God, they're all now starting to leave as well. And so it's not just about the boomers, but, you know, the millennials are behind them. Gen X, that poor group of folks born between 64 and 79, they're getting ignored. They're smaller, but they're also in their 40s and 50s and saying, hey, what about us? No, we are very short-sighted, both as a society, but not just the United States, around the world as well.
It's kind of stunning when you think about it, because you're right. If a huge group of people is born, at a certain time, minus a plague, you know, most of them will be around 20, 30, 40 years from now. I was just so struck by that. It just seems so obvious.
And think of the things that we change. I mean, look around the streets of New Hampshire and New England in general. The schools that were built in the 60s because the boomers were coming. The shopping malls and strip malls that were built because the boomers are shopping. The new houses that went in place in the 50s and 60s, not just for the World War II post-war GIs that came home, but for the 3.9 children that the World War II generation mother had on average. What makes us believe that the infrastructure is not going to have to change as radically for an aging generation? But more importantly than the numbers of the next aging generation, here's the new generation gap: expectations. Because you now have a generation, and by the way, the boomers started this, but they taught their children well, that they not only expect to live longer, they demand to live better. So they're not just going to simply be nearly as polite as their parents and wait on the front porch for the kids to visit. They're not going to wait for the van that they had to book a week in advance to go get a haircut or an ice cream cone. They're not going to accept that Wi-Fi is not part of Maslow's pyramid and it had better be on wherever I live. This is a generation that will demand more and expects more.
Well, it's interesting. And we did a whole mini series recently on New Hampshire's retail and housing infrastructure, highlighting exactly what you say, Joe, that, you know, our housing infrastructure is kind of like that pair of pants that used to fit 15 years ago and all of a sudden it doesn't. Same thing. What do we do with these shopping malls that nobody seems to be going to anymore? So it's interesting to hear you say that. And it reminds me of something else that you write in the book. You kind of got into this field looking at transportation infrastructure. So tell us a little bit about that entry into this field of aging and what older people need. I'll have to ask you to tell us about that on the other side of the break, Joe. I apologize. But
sounds
when we
good.
Do, we'll talk about that. Also, I want to ask you about some of the dire messaging we hear here in New Hampshire, because as you mentioned, we're the nation's second oldest state in terms of median age. So all that's coming up. And stay with us. We'll keep taking your emails and calls. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
You have to go down to the wharf to see the seals.
The City Lights Bookstore.
Go to the Ghirardelli Chocolate Factory.
Contribute to NHPR today, and you could be on your way to San Francisco.
Go to the Cliff House Restaurant, because right nearby is
Muirwoods. Absolutely. It is so astounding.
And, of course, the Golden Gate Bridge. It's bigger and better than you think it is.
Support the news you trust and be entered to win a trip to San Francisco twice. Plus, you'll help cut the March Fund Drive in half at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, why our guest says American businesses, governments, and nonprofits are pretty clueless about aging, and that these stereotypes of elderly people, he says, aren't just off base, they're dangerous. We're talking with Joseph Coughlin, founder and director of the MIT Age Lab and author of the new book, The Longevity Economy. Now, Exchange listeners, what do you think? What images of older people do you see around you? What's the broader narrative that you hear about older folks and our aging society? Again, you can join us by email exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or of course, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Joe, a couple emails and calls, but I did want to ask you about this broader narrative that we hear here in New Hampshire. Dire messages for the last decade or so, at least, that we're the second oldest state in terms of median age, that this is going to be terrible, that we won't have enough young people to get our economy going, to keep our healthcare sector viable, to take care of us, all us old folks, the implication is. How do you interpret this?
You know, I would say that the longevity economy, the growth of an aging population, and by the way, the reduced fertility, that is that, you know, you need 2.1 kids per mom just to keep a population even. Essentially, as education income goes up, that's the best form of birth control, because apparently, as that goes up, fertility now is down to 1.9 or thereabouts for most of the United States. So it's not just about aging. It's about there are fewer children as well. And so this has given rise to an entire business of demography doomsaying, that these disruptive demographics are going to run us broke. They're going to break pension funds and healthcare is going to be busted. And you know something? If we do absolutely nothing, they're probably right. But here's what I want to say to New Hampshire, the United States, and every country around the world, particularly in the industrialized world that's aging. If we change the narrative, if we start thinking about a new population that, by the way, has the highest concentration of wealth in the world, to create new products and services that excite and delight, that will be a new income. If we change the narrative that, yes, retirement is something you can look forward to, but maybe it's not a birthday in a month that you say, okay, I go full ahead, stop. Maybe it's transition. Maybe you work longer to make sure that your wealth span and your lifespan go together. Maybe we continue volunteering well into older age, that we continue to contribute. If we change the story, the most powerful technology in the world is the story. We don't have to have what I like to call that Malthusian logic. If you remember, Thomas Malthus, 220 years ago, said we were all going to starve because the population was growing.
I do remember
well,
that.
Well, now the Malthusians are back because we have achieved the greatest achievement, I think, in humankind, longer life. They're now out there slitting their wrists.
So the folks who predict doomsday, you know, both in terms of bankrupting our finances at the state and federal level, and in terms of, you know, economic doomsday, there just won't be enough active, productive people. They are right if we continue with this narrative.
Absolutely. And they're also assuming the same way Malthus did, that technology won't change, that we won't be able to work longer. But yes, there are robotics and cobotics that will not just take jobs, they will actually keep you working, that we will continue to learn so that we can make the business case to be in the workplace. And that, frankly, people will start to realize that, geez, you know, 20, 30 years, maybe for some 30 plus years of retirement, geez, that's more of a sentence than it is a reward.
So don't think about retirement as, you know, 65, boom, you're gone, thank you very much. More of a gradual sliding scale, and that changes the finances and the economics of it, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And just to just do some very simple geeky math, after, you know, after all, I am sitting here at MIT, but this is basic arithmetic. From 0 to 21 years old, drinking age is 8,000 days. From 21 to what most of us would call midlife crisis, kind of late 40-ish, 8,000 days, and from then to 65, 8,000 days. But get this, if you live a hair over 85, that's 8,000 days. It's a full life stage, not a period.
Well, and speaking of, you know, putting people off the grid, not utilizing them fully, and the impacts, again, we can avoid some of these worst case scenarios if we rethink our narrative. I've got two emails picking up on what you are saying about this. Here's Kim in New London. I could give you the names of 10 highly qualified, energetic, experienced women over 60. I spoke with one yesterday, Kim says, who were laid off from their management position, who cannot get jobs. Kim says they have so much to offer and get lots of interviews and never get the job. Often they are told they are overqualified. What do you think about that?
No, absolutely. We have the pervasiveness of the story that we have around old age. And it's on both sides, if you will, of the ledger. It's on the individual as much as it is on the employer. The employer looks at a person with a developed, experienced resume and say, gee, they would never work here, or I can't afford them.
Right.
They can't make that assumption. So many of us want to go back to work simply to remain busy or to remain purposeful or to, as I said, to have a reason to get up in the morning and see new people. I mean, think of the number of people who have joined the sharing economy as Uber and Lyft drivers and the like that used to go by the name executive vice president. They just want to get out. It's not about the income itself. And on the flip side, as individuals, we now have to realize that if we're going to be working longer, we didn't say we're going to be working longer in the same job. So that means we may be the new kid in the recruitment program going through, shall we say, the recruitment program that 20-something-year-olds are going for and getting paid as a new employee overall. So we need a real adjustment as to our expectations as employees, but employers, not just because it's the law and not discriminate, they need to realize what they're recruiting is talent, not birthdays.
Well, and on this theme of the dangers of putting older people off the grid, disconnecting them, a really compelling email just came in from Bill, Joe. I want to share it with you. He says, my father became more and more afraid as he got older. He definitely felt left out and put upon, and all this was fanned by how he filled his free time, listening to talk radio and watching TV news. Bill says his sense of being disconnected, combined with his fear of being taken advantage of, made him a target for scams. Before we found out what he had been doing, he had squandered the vast majority of his savings to scammers, promising to bring him to D.C. to testify in front of Congress about his plight, or to help them crusade against the concerted efforts of liberals to turn our country into a socialist dictatorship. Wow, Bill, what a story. So when I asked you earlier, Joe, you know, what's the danger of people being disconnected or put off the grid? There's Bill's story right there.
Yeah, first off, there's a special circle of hell for those who prey on the most vulnerable and certainly elderly. So we'll just put that aside. But, you know, one of the things that we have to worry about when we do, both in terms of story and physically and business-wise, put people off the grid, is that as we age, unfortunately, our world becomes more compressed. As one woman said to me in an interview, at my age, and she was in her 80s, there's a natural attrition to friendship. And that is that your friends start to either move or become ill or unfortunately pass away. If you're not working, think about the majority of your social network is not at home. It is not your next door neighbor, but the people that you spend anywhere from 8 to 12 hours a day with at work. So when you leave work, it's less about your income than it is about, shall we say, your social network. So, and yes, the media, if that's all you hear, but you don't get out to experience more in the world, your worldview becomes narrower. And so, yes, you become more vulnerable, but also we as society, we as family members lost the resource, the warmth, and the engagement of that person by allowing them to be on the couch by themselves only with media at their feet.
Bill, thank you so much for that email. Again, you can send us an email like Bill did, exchange@nhpr.org. exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Neil is in Plymouth. Hi, Neil. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I just wanted to tell you that I'm a person that grew up with John Kennedy. It really impressed me a lot. And I'm 68 years old, and I'm not taking my Social Security. I'm still working, and I plan to keep working as long as I can physically work. I've got over 40 years of public service. I served in the legislature, served my community. I've been serving my church, and I feel that older people have so much to offer, that the leadership experience and knowledge of all that work and education shouldn't be, put away.
Set aside. Do you want to keep working, Neil?
Society needs it. Society needs that leadership.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you very much for calling in. And, you know, he's reciting a lot of the themes you have in your book, Joe.
Yeah, absolutely. And Neil brings up something that the last phrase you mentioned, it was knowledge. You know, there is this also part of the old age myth and story is that there's this nice straight linear line, if you will, of people just waiting to take your job. So please retire at 65 and get out of the way and let these younger people who need to get started with life and families and the like to take their job. That is true for some professions. But what Neil is talking about is also very important, is that in certain professions, let me give you an example, in energy, the average age of the energy and electrical workers, in their 50s. The average aerospace engineer, in their 50s. Truck drivers, where there has always been a shortage, average age, 56. And for those of us who come from farming regions, the average American farmer today is 61. So two things are happening. One, there is no long line of younger people who want a lot of the jobs that people are saying, please get out of the way. But to Neil's point, when these people retire or are marginalized and moved out and given the euphemistic package, they take with them not just their cost, not just their labor, but lost knowledge. They take with them the very knowledge that that business or that enterprise knows about what it does, why it did what it does, and how to fix and create relationships and the like with them as well. This is a valuable asset that we are exiting out the door because of an old story of old age.
Although to hear you talk, you know, in those numbers I've heard before, you know, the average age of a doctor is, you know, 53, the average age of a nurse is 50, the truck driver, you know, when you hear that, part of me thinks, okay, maybe those people who say that this demographic wave is going to crash on the sand are right. I mean, eventually those folks are going to retire or die. So then what? There's nobody behind them.
It's going to be a challenge. I try to make a joke out of it because, frankly, you know, laughing is a lot better than crying. But, you know, think about it. With the average doctor being 53, just when we need them most, they're going to want to retire too, perhaps.
Right.
That's where technology plays a role. So I'll give you an example. I've got my family's from very far upstate New York, as in on the Canadian border part of upstate New York. Some of them are receiving Parkinson's therapy and treatment from Johns Hopkins and University of Rochester via telemedicine. So if the doctor is not in the neighborhood, the doctor may still be there to give you the therapy, give you the checkup and the like. So there are going to be ways to leverage the talent and the knowledge we need. But we have to start today to build that infrastructure, that expectation, and the business models to deliver it.
Well, and this gets to one of the innovations that you write about in the book. Really, really quickly, Joe, because we're heading into a break, the exoskeleton helps older workers stay on the job longer.
Yeah, I know it's really robotics and artificial intelligence is getting a bad rap. It's all about how the robots are coming for you and they're coming for your jobs. Well, exoskeletal or robotic suits that one may wear will make it possible for us to work longer on the job. We're seeing the auto industry, particularly in Europe with Daimler and BMW, enabling 50-plus-year-olds not just to stay on the job, but to reduce their injury so that the skills that they've built up over decades and the quality of what they know a car should look like and be built like stays on the job, they stay paid, and the technology is actually a job keeper rather than a job taker.
You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Joe, here's an email from Jim that came in. Jim in Bedford. He says, I'm in the 65-plus group, no longer getting paid for what I do, but it's not golf. Volunteering for my professional society, teaching and taking classes, traveling, things with the grandchildren before they are fully launched. Jim says, I pity the Naples refugees. They let money define, Naples refugees, right? They let money define them in midlife and have lost definition now. Retirement and employment are both modern myths that will need to be rewritten as jobs get automated out of existence and life is transformed. Technology, Jim says, off to class now. Jim, I hope you're still listening. What do you think about his comments, Joe?
I think Jim is edging in on my gig. No, it's he makes a great conversation. And by the way, we haven't talked about retirement in terms of retirement planning, but Jim is emblematic of the way we should be thinking about retirement. It is not simply, and God knows it's not simple, but it is not simply about having enough money and enough income. Similar to what Jim was saying, we now have to be rigorous and work hard in retirement to stay engaged, to find those things that excite us, those things that keep us productive. And it doesn't mean that you're working for pay. It can be volunteering with Verve. It can be maintaining connections to the community. And by the way, who said education is only for those between 0 and 21 years old? It's for a lifetime. So yeah, no, I think Jim is not only a great example, but it's a new way we should be thinking about retirement. Do you have your money is only a one part and a necessary part, but do you have a life, especially for 8,000 days? That's a bigger part.
Well, and you talked earlier, Joe, about the idea of retirement, maybe to avoid some of this economic calamity and demographic calamity and so forth. Maybe we shouldn't think about it as, you know, 65, thank you very much, but it's more of a gradual process, a process where you're sharing knowledge with younger workers. We had a demographer on the show Monday, Peter Francis, who's written a ton on New Hampshire as an older state. He calls it the unbalanced human ecology of our state. And I'm quoting from him here. He says, our state's capacity for economic as well as social rejuvenation and vitality is at risk. What do you think? How much should New Hampshire worry about this?
I think New Hampshire is a living laboratory, particularly for smaller urban areas and rural America in general. And I don't think that it is predestined to be a crisis if we act today. Now, we have to start thinking different about how social institutions have changed, the very nature of social capital. Many of us have dropped out of churches and faith-based organizations of any creed, if you will. And that used to be, shall we say, the very glue for many communities. Rotary, Kiwanis, Moose, and Elks, and the like are now trying desperately to keep members, let alone get new members. So one of the things that we need to think about is not just the infrastructure of aging, but how do we rebuild the social capital to have those connections in small towns in rural America that in many ways made aging better and healthier on a farm 40 acres from your closest neighbor because you were connected in other ways than those who celebrate living in a city right down the hall from somebody they probably never knew.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about social capital. And of course, we've talked with Robert Putnam and the whole idea of bowling alone and social capital. And you do say in the book that this disconnect that older folks used to face wasn't as severe, you know, a generation or two ago because people did participate in church, you know, bowling leagues, Elks Club and so forth. So it's almost a little worse now.
Yeah, I think one of the other parts of the old age as a myth is that we think of retirement as a time to relax, a time to pull back. Actually, retirement's a lot of work. And what I mean by that is that combined with divorce rates, fewer children or children that when you were in youth, you said to your kids that if they don't want to live wherever you are, feel free to move. And they did. So our families are smaller. Our institutions are smaller. We've got to work harder at making those connections.
More on the longevity economy in just a moment. And we'll take a bunch more of your emails and calls. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the founder and director of MIT's Age Lab, Joseph Coughlin, is with us, talking about his new book, The Longevity Economy, some of the narratives and myths we have around aging and how he says those need to change to avoid some of the dire predictions we hear about our aging society. Join us with your comments and questions and your suggestions. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. And wow, Joe, two emails have just come in, and I want to share both of them with you because they take opposite views of some of the themes that you're talking about. Johnny says, call this show the baby boomer whining hour. Self-concerned, aging boomers whine about their place in society instead of the generations they left behind with no careers, no futures, opioids flooding the market to replace the life of meaning that this greedy generation left behind. Johnny says the World War II generation left a promising society behind. The boomers gutted it and are now crying on their way to the grave. Johnny, thank you. And he's echoing some of the themes that Dave in Manchester brought up. And then counter to Johnny and Dave, though, here's Ellis. As a 66-year-old boomer, I'm surprised at this opinion that we are greedy. I see my generation as the group who stood up to stop the Vietnam War, clean up our air and water, make progress in civil rights and voting rights, improve women's rights and financial status, increase access to better and higher education, protect public lands, and so much more. Ellis says many of us work for nonprofits, government, advocacy groups, union jobs, willing to work for a better world at lower wage that could have been made in for-profit companies. Now, for many of us, promises of pensions and health care have been overturned. So, Ellis and Johnny, thank you so much. And wow, Joe.
Geez, I've only been around for 50 plus years. I didn't realize I did so much damage. I'm sorry.
And so much benefit. Like Ellis says.
Well, you know, exactly. I mean, one of the things I always get a chuckle out of is that we like to talk about how younger generations are more environmentally conscious. Well, that is true currently, but the Earth Day movement was not created in the last couple years. The sustainability as a value is not new. And technology development, if you look at who brought the internet to life, it was not necessarily of recent note, so to speak. But that said, yeah, the boomers have definitely got, as I said, Macbeth's blood on their hands, if you will. But the context of life has fundamentally changed. And that is not just about the boomers. Technology has changed. Economics have changed. World powers have changed where they sit, making how we are aging and living very differently. But here's one thing I want to pick up on more than anything else. I'm not going to allocate blame. I don't really particularly, blame is not very useful. But one thing that we have to stop doing is about that generation versus this generation. Because with any luck, all the generations that are younger than the boomers will get to be older. And the responsibility now, I believe, for the baby boomers, if they want to leave a legacy, is to invent a new old age that Gen X, millennials, and Gen Z, and whatever the alphabet soup is that we call after those kids, become older, that they get to live longer, and they get to live better. It's not about us and them. It's about all of us.
Well, I want to thank both of those gentlemen for the emails. And let's talk about some of the companies that are starting to do what you talk about, make old age better, make it more connected, make it not about being off the grid. There's a lot of companies in your book, though, that have showed a general cluelessness about this. Who is sort of getting it right? What sorts of companies are saying, yeah, I understand that older people are not just slow, stupid, sick, needy, greedy?
Yeah, no, I mean, we'll talk about a couple of them. Some of them you may be surprised. And by the way, I do warn you, a lot of them tend to be premium product. And that's a whole other issue we can discuss. And what I mean by premium product is not just premium price, but the values that go into exciting and delighting the older consumer are products that, frankly, please across the generations. By no means do I want anyone to think my book, The Longevity Economy, is about creating products, services, and experiences exclusively for older adults. Rather, we need to be thinking about products, services, and experiences that excite, delight, that are easy, that focus on personal performance, personalization, that make health and well-being a new premium. And if you think about those values, they go across generations. They make life better. No one ever is upset about something that's too safe, too easy, or too much fun. So think about BMW over the years has changed its design, if you will, to be far more intuitive, far easier. Why? Well, frankly, the premium BMW client is in their 50s. How about Apple? And these days you can't have a presentation without what I call the AAA, the Apple, the Amazon, and artificial intelligence as some sort of discussion. But Apple, if you think about the tablet or the iPad, I can take my glasses off, crank up the font with my two fingers, and suddenly I'm still kind of cool having this technology, but I'm not looking at something that says old man's tablet either. And then probably the last one that is something that for those of us who love to cook, OXO Good Grips I talk about in the book. You know, this was a device for potato peelers and the like that was designed by a gentleman when he was watching his wife with arthritic hands have difficulty manipulating kitchen tools. Lo and behold, these larger, easy-to-grip handles now have become the new prestige item in the kitchen. And so whether it's ways we can personalize, better design, or things that just make life easier, these are the things that will make older age better. But guess what? Makes it better for everyone at any age.
Well, another one of the services that you mentioned, I think you say, was invented by or created by a young guy living in maybe New York City, some big urban area. And it was the idea of was it either grocery delivery or these services like Blue Apron where they deliver all the ingredients? You know, and you said this guy invented it because he was just too busy. He was, you know, running around. He had a busy career and he never had time to go to the grocery store, but he never had anything in his fridge. So what did he do? Because this really applies to younger and older as well.
So here's where I will have a little bit of fun at my generation's expense and kick the baby boomers who seem to enjoy kicking the millennials as a part-time sport as every generation takes their turn. But, you know, this lifestyle that we credit the millennials with having, which was home delivery of food or hailing a car rather than owning a car or sharing tools rather than buying tools. Guess what? These very services that make life easy and seamless that we think are being developed for lazy, maybe more affluent kids, guess what? Those kids are creating a virtual assisted living that will make it possible for many of us to stay in our homes, stay safely mobile, and actually stay safely connected and, frankly, well-fed. I mean, the new Meals on Wheels may look a lot more like Blue Apron by drone than, frankly, any way we've ever seen in the past.
Well, and services like Uber or Lyft. I mean, in places like New Hampshire, there's not public transportation. Older folks sometimes can't drive or don't want to drive. And, you know, you talk about how you got into this whole field by looking at the lack of transportation for older folks. And here are millennials inventing something that will help everybody.
Absolutely. I mean, transportation is my first love and started here at the Center for Transportation and Logistics, where the Age Lab is located. But I want you to imagine this. New Hampshire is not alone. 70%, 70 of the 50-plus in America live in suburban and rural areas where there is either no transit or poorly serving transit. And the rides that we often provide to people, you have to book 24 hours in advance, 7 days in advance. And that's great if you want to go to the grocery store or to the doctor's office, but that's mobility triage. Life is not about going to the doctor and the grocery store. It's about the little things like visiting the friend at a drop of a hat. Or my favorite example, when you want an ice cream cone on a hot summer night, it's July, you hear the peepers, you want a soft serve, and you want it now. Do you live in a place that has access to that and the mobility to get you there when you want it? The little things that make you smile is the little things that will make old age living longer better.
And it isn't just, you know, okay, come on, Joe, you can, you know, go to your freezer and get a popsicle. I mean, it's the idea that it brings that little bit of happiness, and that little bit of happiness has long-range repercussions for you.
Absolutely. And frankly, I've spent time in New Hampshire and whatnot, it's like going to ice cream places or even, frankly, the bar in Plymouth and places like that that have those chance collisions, if you will, with people just to say hi or smile or to meet a friend. It's not about the ice cream cone. It's as Jerry Seinfeld said about coffee. When did coffee become a thing rather than a drink? It is now an activity.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. So one of the funniest parts about your book, Joe, is the product makers, often in the tech sector, who've just completely gotten it wrong, created, you know, terrible products with old folks in mind. Just give me some of your favorite examples from that sort of hall of shame.
Well, there's one, and it's not necessarily techie, but it gives you an idea that the ketchup folks came up with senior foods. And I want you to imagine this. It was baby food, quite literally informed by the development of baby food, but with the vision. And here's where that story comes in. The story that older folks apparently don't care about taste, and none of us have our teeth, and frankly, we just need nutrition. And so they created a whole brand of food called senior foods that was mushy, poorly colored, god-awful tasting food product that even babies wouldn't eat. And needless to say, that crashed and burned. But to your point about the tech sector, you know, we look for great innovations coming out of Silicon Valley or even right here in my backyard here at Kendall Square. And for better or for worse, most of those businesses are 20, as I like to frame them, 27-year-old guys wearing sneakers and hoodies programming. And so their vision of old age is either a parent or a grandparent. And without fail, it's always about in old age, the most important thing is to make sure that I remind you to take your medications. So pill reminders galore is what the tech sector seems to think about old age.
Well, and it's interesting, too, there's a demographic disconnect that you write about, that a lot of the new products are created by young guys, whereas the biggest consumers these days are older women. So, I mean, talk about different.
Yeah, no, indeed. One of my favorite chapters in the book is the future is female. And I think my wife tries to make sure I remind me of my own research over and over, as do my two daughters. But I want you to imagine this. The future is female, not just because she tends to live longer. That's part of it. But frankly, the women are the chief consumer officer of the house. Even if she's not an income generator in the house, she's the one who knows how the dollars are spent. 80 cents and 90 cents on the dollar of all healthcare decisions, influencing 80% of all car decisions, home modification, and the like. She, particularly a 47 to 57-year-old, is far more likely to provide care to an older adult, have a husband who can't make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and has been identified by others as being the best friend of an adult millennial child. So she's actually influencing three different houses. So here's the challenge. We're ignoring women when, in fact, they are the lead adopters of a new lifestyle. They're living longer. They're making the consumer decisions. And they're the ones who are going to have to implement it. Indeed, she is the future. And she should be looked at as the guide for what life tomorrow will be.
Well, and speaking of products and being a woman of a certain age myself, here's my last question for you, Joe. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Has somebody made a pickle jar that I can open?
If you find one, I'll buy it too.
Yeah, it drives me crazy. There's been so much more that we could have talked about, Joe. This has been really fun. Thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
It's been great, Laura. Thank you.
That's Joe Coughlin, founder and director of the MIT Age Lab. His new book is called The Longevity Economy, Unlocking the World's Fastest Growing, Most Misunderstood Market. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.